From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Scott Morrison warned the Australian people they'd be shocked and dismayed by the contents of the long-awaited report by Justice Paul Brereton into misconduct by Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan between 2005 and 2016. The report indicates criminal behaviour by rogue elements of the forces, murders and mistreatment of non-combatants and prisoners of war. On the eve of Thursday's release of a redacted version of the report, we spoke to Alan Beam, a specialist in defence and national security issues, who formerly held senior positions in the public service and was advisor to Greg Combe in the Labor government when Combe was junior defence minister. Alan Beam is now with the Australia Institute, a progressive think tank. We canvassed the background to the report, the nature of the special forces, what impact these findings will have, and where to from now for the Australian military. Alan Beam, how did this inquiry get started? When do we begin to hear of these atrocities?
Well, Michelle, the stories about misdemeanors in Afghanistan in particular have been around for quite a long time. But they really gathered a head of steam in 2016 when the commander of special forces in the ADF, Major General Sengelman, thought that it was time to investigate the source of these reports and more particularly what had actually occurred. Now, we did have a whistleblower, as I'm sure you remember, Major McBride, very brave man, I think, to come out and start talking about this sort of stuff. But it was really, I think, General Sengelman talking to General Angus Campbell that set in train the inquiry, which is to be released by Mr. Justice Brereton.
Which has taken a very long time, hasn't it? Because it was supposed to be shorter than this.
Yes, it has taken a long time because what I think the judge has wanted to do is to establish the facts. It is a scoping inquiry, which means that he had to look well beyond the straightforward accusations to look at the context and the circumstances. He did need to talk to witnesses in Afghanistan, which he has done. So it was a pretty painstaking job. And I think it is a good thing, though, now that after a period of 4 years, it has actually come to where it has, which is a public redacted release.
And it did seem that more and more people came out as the inquiry went on.
That is normally the case. People hear about it, they think about it. For those who are more affected by events, their consciences start to come into play. They begin to think, well, there were things that should be brought to the record so that they can be prevented in the future. I mean, a lot of people are extremely well-intentioned in the military and they don't like crimes to be committed on their watch. So it's not surprising that more people would have come out and that we would have had a much more broad-scoped review than perhaps at the beginning anybody imagined.
Could you explain the role of special forces, which are more than just the SAS, aren't they? And how do they differ from regular army personnel? Do they have a distinctive culture? Do they have a very different specialist sort of training?
They are an elite. With everything that that means, elites can be highly problematic. The special forces in Australia have had quite a long history. They came out of the Second World War, where they were initially designed to undertake very perilous, long-range surveillance and reconnaissance patrols to establish what support enemy forces had. And that has changed over time. After Vietnam, the Special Forces in Australia, the SAS Regiment, came very close to being disbanded. And were it not for the Hilton bombing, perhaps we wouldn't actually have a Special Air Services Regiment at the moment. But the need that Australia had after the Hilton bombing for a military capacity to deal with terrorism saved the bacon of the SAS.
Why were they going to be disbanded?
Because they're very, very expensive to maintain. They have very high levels of investment, very high levels of training. And when you come to a period, as we did after 1972, where we came out of Vietnam, it was a war that we shouldn't have been in and which we effectively lost, I think the Australian Defence Force thought, well, we should be relying much more on the conventional capacities of our Defence Force than on the less conventional aspects of defence preparation, which in fact is what special operations forces do.
And they do go beyond the SAS.
Yes. We have a number of special forces in the Australian Defence Force. We have them special clearance divers in the Navy, for example, who do very, very dangerous work. And we have two commando regiments. So these forces are the ones which in 2003 were selected to be deployed in support of the United States in both Iraq, first of all, where in fact the SAS didn't do very much, and then in Afghanistan when we went back for the second time, and in Afghanistan they have actually done a lot.
Now, what do you think is the likely impact of the report? The Prime Minister's really prepared the Australian people to be quite shocked by it. What do you think the impact will be on the Australian community and on the Defence Forces and indeed on veterans?
That also is a huge question, Michelle. I'm prepared personally for a high level of shock when I read the report. And I think that many of us will feel a strong sense of shame that a defence force coming from a country such as Australia, which is a strong upholder of the rule of law and very, very strong participant in international negotiations and conferences and so on, dealing with the laws of armed conflict. We've always been a very big contributor to that. And we pride ourselves on operating our defence force in the framework of the international conventions on warfare and within our own legal frameworks. I think it is going to be quite shocking for many of us, and I think, as I say, we'll feel a sense of shame. I think it will cause a lot of Australians to think quite deeply about the moral peril that we expose our young soldiers to in warfare. It will get many people to think about issues of moral hazard. It will certainly get people to think about what kind of administrative and organisational arrangements within the Australian Defence Force permitted this to happen. It will get people to think about the nature and quality of military leadership. And I think most particularly, it will have quite a lot of people begin to think about the relationship between the highest level of political decision-making, which commits Australian soldiers to warfare, and how that then translates itself into the execution of political decisions. And that is the bit, I think, that will probably demand the greatest amount of consideration, investigation and analysis.
And what about the impact on the Australian Defence Force as such and the ordinary people in it?
Look, I've spent most of my career dealing with the Australian Defence Force. They're wonderful people, and I think they will be both shocked and ashamed that any of their confreres could ever have been involved in this kind of action. I mean, if any of the reports are true, that prisoners were shot dead, that non-combatants were simply wasted, to use the language of warfare, as collateral damage in pursuit of military objectives, many, many ADF people will be very perturbed by that.
What do you think is the root of the problem? Was it moral failure on the part of a few bad eggs? Was it a fault of commanders? Was it even more systemic?
Look, I think it's all of that. I do think that for reasons that we don't quite understand yet, a few bad eggs were able to change the ethos of the special forces and to operate as sort of rogues or vigilantes or something. But for that to happen, there must be systemic failure. And as I said earlier, I think the systemic failure goes all the way back to the beginning. It goes back to the decision to embark Australian defence personnel into a war in 2003 of very doubtful legality, with very unclear strategic objectives, with no clear sense of what victory was going to look like. And so it has rolled on for all this time in an unfinished state with total lack of clarity and, I think, in at best an amoral climate, but as we're beginning to see, with elements of deep-seated immorality in the way in which operations have been carried out. This is extremely worrying.
One problem seems to have been that these people were rotated too often, and that was not necessarily just coming from the top, but also people were earning more money by that and wanted to keep going back. Do you think multiple rotations in that sort of situation is a problem in itself?
I certainly do. Our experience during Vietnam was that we rotated the SAS squadrons just for a year, and then they would come back home and the squadron in training would be rotated. And why, when the squadrons came back home, there was a change in manpower, and generally very few people did more than one rotation in Vietnam. Now we have reports of individuals at least doing more than 10 rotations through Afghanistan. That is partly because of a lack of manpower changeover within the regiment itself, particularly at the other ranks level. The officers change over a lot, but at the other ranks level, they stay fairly constant within the regiment. But I think it's also partly because of what might be seen as perverse incentives, where people will be seduced by remuneration arrangements, but particularly untaxed allowances, which actually substantially enhance their incomes, so that without intending ever to do so, we may have inadvertently created a kind of mercenary attitude within our special forces, which I think is particularly dangerous in a democracy.
When we look at the overall issue, where does responsibility now lie between the military and the government, remembering that these issues stretched right back through a number of governments of both persuasions?
This is a tricky question too. We should always bear in mind the great aphorism of Karl von Clausewitz, that war is the continuation of politics. So that particularly in democracies, war, going to war, conducting war, and then ending it, are always political decisions. So we must at some point have a look at the connection between political decision making and then the execution of defence operational plans. For me, that does demand an in-depth evaluation of the circumstances that had our special forces committed to operations in Iraq and then Afghanistan. And although I know too many people call too frequently for royal commissions. We need something like that to get in behind the quality of decision-making, the nature of advice, the purposive reasons for going to war, what the United States was seeking to achieve, what we were seeking to achieve in support of the United States. All of that needs to be laid out on the table so that we can see the full political context within which people went bad.
It was one problem that this was an uncontested war, unlike the Iraq war, which domestically was politically contested, right? But this one wasn't. So both sides were on board for it, and therefore it was very hard for critics to raise questions about the details of how it was being conducted or what the objectives were, whether they were really going to be attainable or not.
That is absolutely correct. Some of us were critics of the war in Afghanistan from the beginning.
Small minority though, wasn't it?
We were a very small minority to begin with. I think there are many more of us now, Michelle. But at the beginning, it was virtually impossible to get any authenticated information from Australia. And for my part, I used to look all the time to American media reports from American commanders, which were generally much more complete and much more open, and there was more transparency. We just, on our side, the Australian side, simply refused to say anything much at all. And I think that that is highly problematic, because when you are fighting a war such as Afghanistan, which was dressed up as a war against terrorism, and then it morphed into a war against opium, and then it became an ideological war involving terrorism and opium. Then we found that the real enemy was the Taliban. So we did have a pretty clear objective. And we find now that the United States is in negotiation with the Taliban to see how the war can be ended and how US and other forces can be extracted. It's just a mess. And none of that has, I'm afraid, been brought out to anything like sufficient public attention over the last 15 years. And I'd have to say, and I hope I can say this to you, Michelle, this is where a strong and vibrant and quite assertive media is so important. Because if it hadn't been for some of your colleagues, the people at the ABC with, I think, the Sydney Morning Herald and people like Nick McKenzie and others who had kept digging away at this, we probably wouldn't be where we are today.
Now, in terms of the military issues or the issues for the military, can these be fixed while maintaining the existing structures, or should there be a radical solution of disbanding the SAS, which I think they did in Canada when there were issues? Can you just tell us a little about that and what you think about the application here?
The Canadians had quite particular problems of a similar kind, and their decision was to tackle the problem by disbanding their Special Forces Regiment on the grounds that where you have special put in front of regiments and functions and the creation of elites, it is extremely difficult to keep them under appropriate control. In Australia's case, I'm not sure what the Chief of the Defence Force will want to do about this.
What should he want to do?
I think the first thing he will do is to think very carefully about our need for this kind of capacity in our force structure. Do we need to have a couple of regiments of forces whose job is specifically to carry out small and highly lethal operations which are targeted against individuals where there is much fog in the conduct of war in this case? And not only is there much fog, but there's much uncertainty because the adversary does not wear a uniform. The adversary will hide in the civilian population, raising all the questions that the rules of war are really designed to help people make decisions about. So I think the first thing that the CDF would want to do is to establish the need for special forces. The second thing will then be to decide whether we need to have the special forces quarantined, separate from the rest of our forces, whether they're the infantry or the cavalry or the artillery or the armour or whatever, or whether the special forces should be more clearly part of our standing army, perhaps working across the different arms, as we call them, engaging, for instance, cavalry, which is motorised these days, not very many horses involved, but the cavalry and the infantry in particular, and developing a more broad base of expertise and specialty, which is then can be managed under much clearer control arrangements, and perhaps you will militate against the formation of uncontrollable elites or rogue elements simply because you're working across a broader base within the military. But these are specialist military considerations, and I can only sort of speculate a bit as how you might tackle it from a conceptual point of view, but they are very difficult questions, and there's history to be dealt with. I mean, we have a regiment which is highly decorated and highly recognised. At the same time, it is this regiment and this function which is, I'm afraid, has brought this shame upon us, and that will require a lot of evaluation.
Now, just finally, do you think that this deep blemish on Australia's military history will have an impact on the Anzac legend, which has been very much played up, especially by politicians, I think, but not just by politicians, in recent decades, and has sort of taken a new hold on younger generations?
Look, it is a blemish, all right, and it will require, I think, much greater care by our politicians in seeking to get hold of symbolic issues, mostly historical ones, and turning them into sort of normative directions for the way in which we think about ourselves as Australians. There are many Australians who have got no connection whatsoever with the Anzac tradition. You know, their grandparents were born somewhere in Europe or maybe in China or India, and they're not connected with that part of Australia's history. And it's a fairly narrow base now in the makeup of our population. So we've got to be very, very, I think, very thoughtful about the way in which we create icons. I personally have no problems with celebrating Anzac Day, so long as we celebrate it for what it truly is, which is to remember what happened to us as a nation. You know, how 60,000 Australians were killed, another 200,000 were injured. It affected Australia very deeply, the boisterous and buoyant Australia that we had immediately after Federation turned inwards after 1918, and we came very much preoccupied with ourselves. We lost our mojo, and we lost it for 20 years. So we've got to be careful in the way in which we use those myths as ways of framing our own national narrative. And if this causes us to be a bit more thoughtful about that, then it's possibly a good thing. We might be able to get a little bit of benefit out of what is a pretty sad indictment of some part of our military behaviour.
Alan Beam, thank you very much for talking with us today and giving us background to what's going to be a shocking but very important report. And that's all for today's podcast. Thank you to my producer, Tom Glassie. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevier. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.